Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Come Play, which is based on a short film called Larry. And it's about a creature that lives inside your screens. I guess that's the simplest way to put it. You got any other ways you want to sum it up?
Well, Larry struck me initially giving the movie the benefit of the doubt as a little bit more of a free-range ghoul, but he does seem to haunt specifically electronic and cellular devices. That's this movie's gimmick. It's not that it's never been done, but this movie really kind of goes whole hog on it in a way that I found a little difficult to take seriously. Not to put the cart before the horse.
Right. Movie follows a family, parents John Gallagher Jr. and Gillian Jacobs, who have an autistic son who is nonverbal. He communicates primarily by using an app on a phone where he basically taps out buttons that say different words and strings together sentences that way in order to communicate. And being that he's nonverbal and being that this is the way that he communicates, he spends a lot of time with screens. He's a big SpongeBob fan. And then suddenly he gets invited to be friends with Larry.
Yeah, you want a pithy, like, elevator pitch for this movie? It's a Kindle Babadook. It's an e-reader Babadook. And every bit as less charming than the original as you could imagine that being. I'm not a big e-reader guy. I don't have like a fetishistic devotion to hard copies. I listen to like a lot of audiobooks on the internet, but it's primarily that's how I consume most literature these days. So I'm not like a Mormon, or I'm not Amish about when it comes to these matters. You know, I'm not like some displaced time traveler, but I don't know. I mean, swiping from page to page like you're on fucking Tinder is just, it makes the menace in this movie less credible, I found, than having physical pages to turn. There's just not as much trepidation, you know? A swipe can be done so quickly. I mean, it's automatic. If you've been on any dating apps or just any social media apps of any kind, whereas turning a page, I mean, you also do that automatically, but there's a moment of suspense there. It's like parting a curtain, you know, it's a little more theatrical. Swipe. I don't know. It just robbed it of so much of its mysticism. So,
well,
it's no Babadook is what I'm saying, but that probably went without saying.
Yeah. Well, before we put any more carts in front of any more horses, I think maybe we'll just launch into the synopsis.
We open with a kid in bed watching SpongeBob on his iPhone. We linger on the screen for kind of a really long time. SpongeBob gets several full sentences out. The kid has walked out of frame, either run off to the bathroom or some other bit of household business. And we see SpongeBob getting up to hijinks. I said this in our Pet Sematary review. Missed opportunity. Way back when we talked about Pet Sematary, there's a SpongeBob clip in that movie, and I thought, why not the hash-slinging slasher episode? If you're trying to establish a horror ambiance, you know, throw me a fucking bone here. Not one hash-slinging slasher clip in this entire movie, which is rife with SpongeBob clips, as we've said. Anyway, we get a monster's eye view, and we know this because there's a lot of heavy breathing attending it, from the other side of the phone. It's like there's an iPhone screen shaped porthole through which the monster is peering at a child's bedroom. And then we get our title drop, Come Play. We get a sense of Oliver's life and his routine. His parents are, if not separate, his parents don't live together. It's not clear exactly what the situation is there. Their relationship is strained.
Well, no, they live together and then he moves out.
Is that what is that? Oh, right. But that happens basically right now. I mean, it's one of the first things that we bear witness to.
I thought it took a good half an hour or 40 minutes.
Did it? Well, it is the first time you see the dad, though, is it not?
I mean, you see him sleeping on the couch during the first night encounter, and then he's there the next morning after Oliver was screaming and woke up his mom.
Okay, yeah. I've been a little bit off my game lately. Last four episodes we recorded on consecutive Wednesdays. First Wednesday was January 6th. Then the following Wednesday was impeachment proceedings getting underway. So I've been glued to Twitter for like the last four episodes running. I don't know what my excuse today is. I've failed to heed the film's warning, I guess. I'm just too wrapped up in my devices. to do my fucking job. Anyway, the dad moves out in short order. In the meantime, we see Oliver get acquainted with this spooky app that has downloaded itself onto his phone. It's a storybook called Misunderstood Monsters. We see, we've been griping about this a lot lately, Polaroid-esque boogeyman, sort of deviant art imagery.
Well, this one, and I made a crack about
this, he's a little more
this.
Differentiated.
This one just looks like a stretched out version of The Rake.
Okay.
If you're familiar, I know, Matt, you're familiar, but our listeners, if you're familiar with what The Rake looks like, or just go on Google image search, I'm pretty sure the first result of The Rake will kind of convey this idea.
Yeah, I mean, everything that's not what you'd expect, you know, everything that's not a gardening implement is going to be...
Right. Just a sort of skeletal, semi-human homunculus with kind of spindly fingers, or I think in The Rake's case, they're kind of
claws
or blades even.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Rake was always sort of like a B-tier creepypasta, a member of the creepypasta rogues gallery. He's no Slender Man in terms of his cultural influence, but he's like the Mad Hatter to Slender Man's Joker.
Right. But I guess basically, to put it even more pointedly, he's really a cross between Slender Man and
The
Rake.
That's what I was
going to
say. He's got the physique of Slender Man. He's like a dressed down, or not dressed at all, Slender Man. He's not as dapper.
It's The Rake stretched to Slender Man's proportions.
So Oliver starts, as I was griping about before, thumbing through this spooky story. And it's a very green eggs and ham. You know, every page has a rhyme on it, or a pair of rhymes. Would be spooky couplets. I don't remember any of them offhand, but it's all about how Larry is lonely and he just wants a friend. And if you become friends with Larry, he'll drag you to hell, basically. That's sort of what it boils down to. And the kid gets spooked, understandably, pulls the covers over his head. And you think that there's some kind of apparition. Again, we're seeing through Oliver's eyes through the blanket, so it's difficult to make out, but we think that we see a shape at the foot of his bed. Turns out he's just got like Wilson from Castaway hanging on his bedroom door. He's got like a face on a volleyball, looks like, or yeah, some kind of ball, and like a shirt hanging underneath it. So there's a little bit of a fake out there. I don't think much else comes of this encounter. The point we quickly come to learn is that the deeper you get into the book, the more corporeal Larry becomes.
Yeah. So this is the aforementioned encounter, which ends in Oliver screaming and his mom waking up and coming in, calming him down. The next morning, dad has not yet moved out. He's making a little more light of it. Oh, you know, kids have nightmares. It's fine.
He's the more aloof of the two of them. And I guess the fact that he was sleeping on the couch is telling. They've been having issues.
Right. Oliver goes to school. Unsurprisingly, he is something of an outcast. Kids make fun of him because kids can be really shitty.
He's the subject of much envy because he is allowed to have his phone on him during class because he uses it to talk,
as opposed to play Fortnite.
Right.
And that is not just me making a joke. There is dialogue about that.
Yes.
From the teacher.
He draws the ire of one kid in particular, name of
Byron.
Byron.
No child has been named Byron in the last 80 years.
And he is a brooding, Byronic figure, to be sure. He sends one of his lackeys. This isn't made 100% explicit, but we intuit it almost immediately, basically immediately. He sends one of his lackeys to lure Oliver into a trap. It's like the coat scene in Goodfellas, but like a kindergarten version, like where De Niro was waving Lorraine Bracco down the street. Oh, it's just a little further. And she, you know, gets scared and bails. Oliver is not so fortunate. He is led into a field, and a gang of them, led by Byron, they don't lay into him the way you would expect in like a cheesy movie bully way. It's not like they kick the tar out of him. They torment him a little verbally, and then they take his phone and throw it into a hedge or like into some reeds, and that's about the extent of it.
Yeah. And now the kid can't talk, Then he's got to.
Sure, I'm not saying they went easy on him.
No, I know.
I'm just saying that it's not as contrived as the average bully and his victim encounter in a movie like this.
Right. No, that's not what I was getting at. I was just, this is an issue which leads to, you know, his mom tracking him down after a length of time and being worried because he can't get home and she can't find him for a little while.
Yeah. Dad works as a security guard, night watchman, looks like.
Not even. He's just a parking lot attendant.
Anyway.
He just sits in the booth.
Whatever his position is, he has purview over the lost and found box, which is some authority, I guess, because he can just help himself to a slightly cracked iPad and bring it home for his son. His wife is a little put out because she gets to be the parent, solo it all day long, and then he swoops in and saves the day. Those are her words, I think. So he gives the kid a new device. Oliver is elated, runs upstairs, starts testing out its capabilities. He's doing an app with various filters, you know, masks for your face, football helmets and horse heads and so on. And this was a trick that I saw in Host last year, which we did not cover, but a filter starts affixing itself to an invisible presence in the room as though there were a face floating over his shoulder.
Yeah, it's spooky too, because the mask he has switched to at this point is one of those like Dia de los Muertos skeleton faces.
Yeah, like, by way of like the Misfits logo.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
And it plays out predictably. It's 15 feet away until all of a sudden, oh, it's 4 feet away. And there's a scare cord accompanying that. Let's see. Oliver is in some kind of speech therapy class, maybe just regular therapy, but they're working on his speech.
Speech therapy. Yeah. They refer to it as speech therapy.
Trying to get him to recite basic sentences. They're trying to get him to work on the F consonant particularly. They're trying to get him to say something field. Field is the operative word. He can't get past th. And I mention this only because, believe it or not, it kind of matters a little bit.
It does come back.
Oliver has a slumber party, and wouldn't you know it, the three bullies who accosted him in a field, oh no, I might have given the game away, are the only people that his mother thinks to invite. Byron, I keep wanting to call him Damien, like it's the Omen, because those are the vibes he gives off. Byron is the mother's friend's son.
And so apparently they used to play together.
Yes,
there's some prior time.
There's an incident, and the parents had a falling out that is frequently alluded to, but never elaborated upon. At least not yet.
Yeah, not yet.
So the slumber party is a drag, but nothing too traumatic comes of it until the three ne'er-do-wells can't fall asleep because Oliver is muttering as a scene that we jumped over. What is it that precipitates him locking up? Oh, I remember. The monster introduces itself to him through his speak and spell app.
Right.
It speaks to him, "I am Larry." That kind of thing. There's a dedicated button for Larry, apparently. Although I suppose it's a whatever, it's paranormal.
It can do probably, whatever it wants.
Yeah, probably say whatever it damn well pleases.
Yeah.
So Oliver has, subsequent to this, thrown his phone into a little like Harry Potter vestibule under
the
staircase.
The tablet. Phone's already gone.
That's his device. Yeah. His iPad. Under the stairs, and he is lying on the floor on a cot or sleeping bag, slumber party, and staring at the little door under the stairs and muttering to himself, keeping his bullies awake, his slumber party guests awake. So they go to investigate. They want to know what he's staring at. They fish the tablet out of the closet, and wouldn't you know it, Larry was good enough to pull up story time for them. So they start thumbing through it. They get deeper into it this time. Something about how Larry watches through your screens that connects his world to yours. You know the drill. The bridge is getting less tenuous.
Larry watches through your screens. Now he's coming to eat your beans or some nonsense. This culminates in, first of all, Byron like keeps reading when clearly the...
He will eat them on a plane. He will eat them in the rain.
Should I keep reading, guys?
Yeah, toxic masculinity has set in early for Byron. And so he proceeds to get into a pissing match with the monster, wherein he refuses to chicken out and keeps reading, even up to the point where Larry materializes in the room and they can only see him through the tablet screen, like through the camera, effectively.
Yeah. Byron fucking walks over to the corner of the room where Larry is, like, he's not there. It's just on the tablet. It's just in the app. And then, you know, he starts getting fucking strangled, basically.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the kid because whatever that generation is called, you know, they grew up with Slender Man from infancy. You know, they've if you've got, I mean, they're used to, you know, fucking Charlie Challenge and all that garbage, you know. This is Slumber Party 101. You know, you're supposed to scare yourself witless with Bloody Mary and all that stuff. So ordinarily he would have been, you know, 99 times out of 100 he would have been the coolest kid in the room,
right?
And like, there was no such thing as Candyman, only it's just his luck that he happens to be in a horror movie,
right?
So Larry proceeds to throttle him,
but the kid makes it because I don't know, Larry's really not that bloodthirsty, as it turns out.
Yeah, pulling his punches, at least so far.
The parents of the three bullies show up, take them home. Parents are asking their children what happened, and all of them rat on Oliver as opposed to saying there was this thing in the house.
Yeah, they all say Oliver did it. It was Oliver's fault. And then don't
elaborate.
Well, I figured when the scene with Larry strangling the kid was playing out, I thought, oh, good. Oliver is in the opposite corner. This movie's not going to do the hack thing where they blame the misfit kid for it all going south somehow. You know, it's not like his mother ran downstairs. It would have been different if Oliver had run in, tried to save Damien,
right,
and been like shaking him, and then his mother had seen him shaking him and thought like, no, Oliver, stop that kind of thing,
right?
Like, they weren't setting up an it was Oliver's fault thing, but then they just did it anyway. So I felt kind of cheated by that, and I wouldn't have liked it anyway, you know, even if they had prepared for it better, just because I think that trope is, like I said, a little bit hack. This is also the scene where the word freak is deployed. I think I complained about this in our review of Brahms the Boy 2. No one says freak, as far as I know, anymore, or possibly ever. It's always you freak in movies like this. That kid's a freak. I don't know. It's always sounded wrong to my ears, so I have to rescind a little bit of the praise that I showered on the earlier field scene, where I thought it was a cut above the average, like, bullying depiction in a movie of this kind. So the mother is now wising up to what's going on slowly but surely. She has somewhat humorously brought home a shitload of light bulbs. We have not talked about this. Every time Larry shows up, light bulbs start shorting out all around him in a shower of sparks.
Yeah, because he travels apparently not exclusively by screens, but also by just electrical objects.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, busts a lot of bulbs.
Yeah, so Oliver's poor mother is, for what we assume must not be the first time, just completely restocking all of the light bulbs, at least on the first floor, all of the ones in the immediate vicinity of the slumber party. And we get some, it's like the chair pyramid in Poltergeist. She'll walk over to the kitchen to do something, and then when she turns back around, things aren't where she left them. And that plays out for some time with lampshades shaking and the tablet moving around.
Well, yeah, mostly it's the tablet moving around, and then the culmination is she turns around and all the lamps are on when she had not even installed a single new light bulb. So she's like, well, that's fucked. First, she thinks it's her husband dropping by, who has moved out by this point, but he's definitely not there, so.
The phone starts talking to her. I feel like there must have been some preamble that I'm forgetting, but it does escalate fairly quickly. The phone, as it did with Oliver, Larry kind of introduces himself and says, say goodbye to Oliver. It's not clear what she thinks. I thought at first that she thought that her phone, the word she uses in a minute or two is hacked. I thought, I mean, the rational, like the terrestrial explanation for all of this is that
terrestrial internet pervert.
Yeah, has been scoping out her son by hacking his webcam. And so she's talking to the creep and saying, like, I won't let you hurt Oliver. And through the speaking app, the monster says, not hurt.
Take.
So she runs to school, scoops up Oliver in the middle of some presentation, runs out with him, gets a call from her friend, Byron's mother, goes over to her place. Byron has been catatonic for like 48 hours, hasn't been to school. He finally starts talking to fess up that Oliver did not render him catatonic.
It was Larry. And the mother is never like, who have you been letting around my son?
Right,
you
know, Byron's mother, yes.
Right, that's the thing you would expect the mother to do in that situation, the mother of the other child, Byron's mother. You would expect her to think Larry is some strange man that...
has been, like, watching them sit on balloons or, you know, some other reprehensible niche internet kink.
Yeah.
You know, that's a best case scenario.
Right. But it never gets there.
So they run home, Oliver and his mother, and they're throwing a bunch of stuff into a bag. They're fleeing the house. It's still not clear exactly what she thinks is going on. Oliver has a rendezvous with Larry in his room. This is weird, and not, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think anything ever really comes of it. Oliver gives him a sponge, like a regular dish sponge. I mean, the kid has a thing for SpongeBob, but there's a very E.T.-esque shot of a very E.T.-esque hand, like, reaching over the side of his bed and, like, poking a sponge towards him across the mattress. And Oliver, I think, takes it.
Yeah, no, he takes it and puts it in his bag, and he's playing with it later. But I thought, like, okay, is Larry, did he possess the sponge?
I don't know, does it have some totemic significance? Is it a Wi-Fi-enabled sponge? I'm pretty sure his powers don't extend beyond. The movie is at pains to impress this upon us, not yet, but soon, that he afflicts plugged-in people specifically.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Oliver and his mother flee to Dad's flop house.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's really like a dingy basement situation that he's living in. And, yeah, Dad inadvertently gaslights Mom, as is always the case in these situations. You know, just thinks that she hasn't been getting enough sleep and Oliver's running her ragged. I'll just take Oliver to work with me, and if we're going to keep him out of school, it's okay that I'm working a night shift and he's going to be with me. You stay here, you get some sleep. Basically, the two of them, Dad and son, encounter Larry at the parking lot, and Dad is fully clued in.
Yes, the scales fall from his eyes, and then he comes home with Oliver. And he and the mom, the parents, proceed to connect a lot of dots very quickly. They're typical for a movie like this, fairly slow on the uptake. And then in this 30-second exchange, they try to make up for lost time and cover as much ground as possible. They figure out everything to do with windows becoming doors and Larry entering our world through screens and so on. Because the dad at this point has read much of the story. Every time the story comes up, we wade a little bit deeper into it. So he figures, oh, well, we'll just destroy the tablet and then Larry will be at an impasse.
Yeah.
And I'm already thinking, like, this is not the first haunted device that your son has had. One of them is still just in a field somewhere. Again, the operative word. But I don't know. I guess they don't know that. So then there's a kind of funny, maybe not on purpose, scene where the dad is smashing the phone with a hammer, and we see from Larry's perspective his porthole getting
crack,
you know, spider webbing cracks, and he goes.
Yeah, I think Mom and Dad are both like taking turns with hammers, like it's Office Space or something, just going to town on the tablet.
Yeah, damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Die, motherfucker, die, motherfucker, die.
Oliver, somewhat adorably, is standing off to the side during all of this, wearing plastic safety goggles, because they wouldn't want him to catch any flack. So that's
Larry Shrapnel.
Yeah, God knows what would happen if you took a piece of haunted glass to the eye. I want to see that horror movie. That sounds fucking terrifying. Might play out something like that segment from VHS 2. I think it's VHS 2. It might have been the first one. Do you remember the guy with the, like, haunted ocular implant of some kind?
Yeah, that's definitely 2.
Yeah, that was rather good. Yeah. Anyway.
So there's some more events of very little note, and then Dad goes back to work solo, and suddenly his phone has misunderstood monsters on it, and then he just starts swiping through it at lightning speed, even though they figured out that the further you read into it, the worse it gets.
And
once
even as he's exclaiming, oh no,
he just keeps going. Why? Why are you doing this, John Gallagher Jr.? What are you thinking? So, yeah, sure enough, he swipes so far that Larry knocks out all of the lampposts in the parking lot and starts hopping car to car, setting off alarms and making lights flicker and so forth. And then suddenly he's just perched beside the booth. And Dad is using his phone, like, basically the same... Well, I think... No,
it's the way
it's just
all
the
these
camera.
Scenes play yeah. out, yeah.
He's using the camera to look through the phone to see, oh, where is he? It's like, but can't you tell just from the noises? Like,
right.
Larry is not being very quiet at this point. They tussle, Larry gets inside the booth, and then Dad gets out and flees to his truck.
There's a high-speed pursuit. And the dad is still swinging his phone around. Well, where's Larry? Where's Larry?
That doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, you just step on it. Just, what do you propose to do?
He's knocking out all the lights behind you. Just move.
Yeah, eyes on the road.
First, Larry is in the bed of the truck, and then he's not. And then he's in the passenger seat, which causes Dad to crash. He ends up in the hospital, not dead, because, again, this movie is a little bit chicken shit when it comes to body count.
Maybe Larry really does just want a friend.
I guess.
He's just going about it all wrong.
He's just a little too aggressive. The police call Mom and are trying to talk to her, but Larry is interrupting the phone call, it seems like, causing interference. And this is when Larry basically goes into his end game.
Yeah, he clambers atop a soapbox of sorts, first of all. He hijacks the flat screen in their den, and we got a montage of channel surfing, we're meant to think. I caught Back to the Future and Red Dragon and a bunch of news segments, weathermen and news anchors and so on, random cartoons, stringing together one word at a time, a semi-coherent sentence from the monster's perspective. You created Larry with loneliness. Your devices, it literally says that you spent your whole life staring at screens. There's this Luddite villain monologue that just sort of goes on and on, and the whole time the mother is standing there impotently. Oh, right, so here the end game. The book Misunderstood Monsters comes up on the TV, and the mother is standing there impotently jabbing a button on the remote, trying to turn the TV off as page after page is turned automatically.
Yeah, it's swiping itself, which I think is cheating. Apparently Larry doesn't have rules.
Yeah, so often do cheat. Only after we see the words "the end" come up on the screen does she think to yank the TV out of the wall, which probably wouldn't have helped because Larry can basically do what he wants, seems like. But still, would you not have resorted to that sooner rather than trying to... I mean, effectively, there aren't even batteries in that remote control for all the good that it's doing you.
Right. She throws the TV out. She throws out a bunch of other screens, you know, laptop, desktop, apparently. They've got like a box of old phones that she also throws out. They've got an awful lot of devices.
More lost and found pickings, probably.
They've got an awful lot of devices for a guy that apparently works as a parking lot attendant and a woman who... She does not appear to have a job, so I don't know how they afford all of these fucking devices. But nevertheless...
Maybe they always buy cheap phones that crap out after a year. I mean, that's semi-plausible for a family that's not well-to-do, and it is expensive to be poor.
Well, yeah, but I guess having the desktop and the laptop on top of this... The box of old phones in and of itself, I guess, is not that weird. That is a plausible explanation. Just... There seem to have been an awful lot of screens in the broad sense.
Well, I also live in a pretty nice multi-story house. Even if the dad moves out and finds a dump, he can still afford to pay rent. And, you know, anyway, yeah, they don't seem like they're... So often, families in horror movies that are supposed to be struggling are anything but...
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm getting at. One of those.
Yeah.
Larry, at this point, is tromping around the house.
You no longer need the phone to see him. Thank God. We can just use our eyes.
Right.
So I'm getting real tired of that routine, that whole song and dance.
At one point, Oliver stuns Larry by breaking some of the light bulbs, which is backward.
Yeah, that was befuddling.
Yeah, Larry was breaking them himself before, so he was hurting himself the whole time. Is it whatever?
He's his own worst enemy. That's what I keep saying.
Mother,
misunderstood monster.
Mother and son make it upstairs to his bedroom and hide under the bed. Mom is trying to keep Oliver quiet. Eventually, Larry is tromping around the room and standing on the bed and so forth. Just starts shouting, "Field, field, field, field."
After multiple minutes of going upstairs and downstairs, and the kid, you know, it's like hiding from the raptors in Jurassic Park. The kid keeps a lid on it for so long, and then, yeah, he just starts saying, "Field, field, field." Like, at first I thought, like, he's not a fucking parrot. Like, is he just saying that because that's what his speech therapist was working on him with? But no, it reminded me of the end of Signs, you know, where it turns out that everything happened for a reason. Oh, that's why there's water all over the house, and that's why Mel Gibson's wife had to die. All of that stuff. It's, you know, it's just a throwaway detail that happens to portend a third act climactic twist. So he grabs his mother, they run out of the house, they make it to an empty field.
The empty field.
The empty field, crucially. And the mother, finally catching on, says, "Oh, there's no electricity out here.
We'll just live here forever."
Not a cell phone in sight, just people living in the moment.
Unfortunately, there is a cell phone out of sight, and Larry
in a hedge
climbs out of the tall grass and starts chasing after them. He corners them in the woods, and he's holding out his hand. Mom and son have been separated again by this point. He's holding out his hand. Oliver is stretching his hand out slowly to take it. And then Mom, rather than showing up and just pulling Oliver's hand away, she's like, "No, no, I will take Larry's hand." And then there's this weird monologue about how we both want the same thing. We both want to protect Oliver. Which, what?
It's not at all apparent.
No.
There's multiple points where Oliver is being set upon by bullies and the monster could have maybe interceded on his behalf and didn't. It's kind of contrived for movies like this about boogeymen to be movies about, like, overzealous guardian angels. You know?
Right.
But so I was kind of glad to see that this movie didn't take that tack, but apparently that's what this movie thought that it was doing, at least on the basis of that line.
Yeah. Mom then has her hand in Larry's hand, and she's giving her tearful goodbye to Oliver, and crucially, he finally looks her in the eye. He never makes eye contact with her, ever.
Mm-hmm.
But he's doing this now.
Looks directly into the camera.
Yeah, and then she smiles and then gets the ringed by Larry. Basically,
yeah,
he clasps his hand down around her hand.
Lingers on her face. Takes a good long while for all of the vim to sort of leak out of her. It's the spookiest image in the whole movie.
Oh, for sure. I know I kind of just denigrated it by calling it like a knockoff ring, but it really is. Looking at it, I felt like I should be feeling as though it were hack, but it really worked.
Yeah, I mean, the imagery works. Everything surrounding it that could have prepared you for it emotionally is sort of a house of cards.
Absolutely right. But the image, and there's kind of a, you know, a spooky noise.
Yeah, like
and
a
her
dry, rustling, kind of, not, well, that sounded like he's got a bendy straw in her skull or something. Like he's one of
I drink your milkshake.
Yeah, like he's the fucking Mama Grub from Starship Troopers. It's not like that.
No.
But point being, she's having her soul siphoned out.
Yeah. And then before she goes full Last Crusade, she gets dashed off with Larry into the woods at lightning speed. We cut to a little epilogue where Dad has stepped up. He's taken Oliver to speech therapy, which is going well. He's saying, like, "Mom loves me," and things like this. Dad's taking notes on his instructions from the speech therapist, and they're just talking about, like, "I hope they find her, and I miss her," and blah, blah, blah. And then it's night back at home. Dad is upstairs in bed, and he hears laughter from downstairs. He goes downstairs and he sees Oliver spinning in a circle with his arms out like he's holding hands with somebody and they're spinning in tandem. So Dad breaks out his phone once Oliver starts like also flying through the air a little bit.
Yeah, and then more than a little bit.
Right.
He's being sort of tornadoed around.
Dad pulls out his phone and we see a sort of skeletal well, not skeletal, but sort of corpse-like female figure, which we are to intuit is Mom.
I was anxious to see her face more than anything. I mean, going by Oliver's reaction, her face does not look the way it looked the last time we saw her, because otherwise he would be shrieking.
Right.
But
you would think.
But she's wearing this tattered black dress that makes it look like she died in the 1870s, which I thought was pretty silly, given that she's should be, you know, just being a ghost doesn't automatically make you from the before times, you know. Doesn't automatically make you antiquated. I mean, she died in 2020 or whatever. That's, I don't know, stupid.
I mean, I didn't get that close a look at it. I feel like it might have just been like a tattered, like, long sweater.
Maybe.
And she might have been wearing something like that when she died. So I didn't give it too much thought. But yeah, Dad seems comforted by this. He's got like almost tears of joy going on.
He is watching all of this through his phone camera, by the way.
Filming his experiences
having
rather than
learned,
living them.
Having learned nothing from this whole ordeal.
And then we have like a voiceover line from Mom saying, I'll always protect you. And we see again Oliver's face looking into the camera. And I thought we were going to see what she looked like, but no, it just cuts to black from there.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we'll go ahead and take our break here, and then we'll be back with some more thoughts afterwards.
What are you staring at? Hey! What's this? This is Larry. He isn't from the world you know. Larry just wants a friend. Maybe we should stop reading. Will you be Larry's friend?
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Did you turn it on?
Finish the story.
He just wants a friend.
And we're back. So I'm going to sound like a, I don't know, like a tight ass when I say this.
A tight ass!
A sadist! Absentee landlord does not make sense in this context. But in these movies, there are rules, whether stated or implied. And these movies never fucking follow the rules. And it drives me up a fucking wall.
I am usually put off by that. I find that some movies, so like a Gary Dauberman joint or like James Wan, you know, which is, there's a lot of overlap there.
Right.
Those movies have a very unimaginative approach where they, you know, anything about the fucking Warrens will lay out the rules very meticulously. So it's unignorable when the rules get violated later on. This movie, there's a lot more implication, and I can make some allowances for rules getting bent and broken because Larry is accruing power steadily throughout the movie. But it is still disappointing to just, it breaks the spirit of the law when Larry forces them to finish the book against their will. I mean, but it's equally stupid when the dad finishes it for
no reason.
For utterly inexplicable reasons. Reasons that defy explanation.
I grant you that some of it is explainable when you put it down to, like you say, Larry gathering power. But way back at the beginning of the fucking movie, there is an early scene of Dad alone. We elided this. Dad alone when he gets the tablet. He's alone at work.
Oh,
at
yeah.
Night.
Yeah.
And there's just this wind that blows up kind of out of nowhere. And it blows, like, an obnoxious amount of newspaper around.
It looked like Robert De Niro's death scene in Brazil, where he gets eaten by scraps of trash. A news truck has overturned out of frame, and dozens of newspapers have blown up against an invisible figure.
Right. And at this point, Oliver has barely engaged with Larry. It's only happened the one time. Dad has had no interaction with Larry whatsoever.
Oliver has made it all of 4 pages into the book, I think.
And yet, Larry is haunting Dad already.
Right.
That doesn't sit well with me.
No, nor I.
It's not how this is supposed to work. I grant you, as silly as all of the newspapers being, in concept at least, I like the idea. Maybe it just shouldn't have been there. You know, maybe it should have been later in the movie. Maybe I would have liked it better.
Yeah.
But there it's just like, it's not even established at that point that you need to like finish the story for Larry to be freed or whatever. But the premise of this movie that I was reading everywhere is like a monster in your devices that takes advantage of the innocence of children. Okay, well, that's clearly not what's happening when he's haunting Dad at the parking lot.
Yeah,
he's just hanging out.
The only thing to come of that scene is that the dad finds a new device to bring home. So if Larry had a hand in that somehow, that's kind of a spooky notion. But there's nothing supernatural about the dad rifling through the lost and found box. I mean, he knows that his son's cell phone has gone missing. It's not like he just happens to bring a device home without really knowing why. Or, like, finds it in his pocket when he gets home and is like, well, how did that get there? It's nothing like that. And Larry doesn't appear to... He's not a chess master. He's not moving these pieces into formation. He's just kind of creeping on Dad, like you said, while he's at work. It should have been... I mean, I feel like they wanted to establish what the dad does for a living, since a weird amount of this movie takes place in his little booth, especially, like, the back half of it after mother and son flee the house.
Right.
But it's not necessary for anything overtly paranormal to happen in that scene just to maintain audience interest, you know, but just have a light flicker. We already know that that is ominous because of Larry. If anything, it's worse to not know exactly where Larry is, knowing that he's exactly X number of feet away. And we didn't even talk about this.
Yeah.
What is it? A range finder? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. So there's, and they do prepare for this. Because I get the sense, based on the truck that Dad drives, looks like kind of like a contractor's truck. It's got those rails over the bed, and it's, you know, full of tools and shit. And I guess he's like an out-of-work contractor, and that's why he's working at a fucking parking lot as an attendant. So he has all these gadgets for construction. So he's got one of those laser rangefinder things.
It's a sci-fi tape measure. Basically, it tells you how far away you are from a given surface.
Yeah, and in the introduction of this device, it's the morning after Oliver's first Larry encounter that Mom thinks is a nightmare, and he's range-finding to his son, like, do you need a hug? Well, 10 feet 3 inches is too far away for a hug. It's all cute and whatever.
It's a Chekhov's gun, if ever there was one,
yeah,
is what it is.
Chekhov's range-finder. Chekhov's laser. Oliver takes that out of his dad's utility bag or toolbox or whatever while Dad's trying to fix the light in the booth, which Larry has knocked out. And Oliver's just fooling around with the laser thing. And most of the stuff he's hitting, it's like 400 feet away. And then he's moving the laser around, and then all of a sudden it drops to like 50 feet.
Yeah,
and then he's
41,
he's
and then 33.
It's slower than that, though. It goes down by increments of like 6 to 14 inches.
And you hear unhurried footsteps, and then he picks up the pace. But at first, it's like something you'd hear in a film noir. It's like a PI walking down, I don't know, like a rainy street, like the thump, thump, thump. It's interminable.
Clack, clack. Yeah.
And then, as if that didn't defang Larry enough, the kid, and this was also prepared for, and I did not have this pegged as a Chekhov's goo hand, whatever they're called. He takes one of those sticky hands out of his pocket.
It's on like a long, stretchy string, and then you slap it against the wall, and you have to peel it off.
Yeah, and he slaps it against Larry's torso, or his face, I don't know, but
or
it looks
something.
Like his midsection. He's very tall.
Yeah, he is very, very tall. Yeah, also, he just stands there when Larry's 3 feet away and does that, but not much else. And then Dad, like, sees that Oliver's walked away and runs out and grabs him.
And it's weird because we see the kid having episodes, panic attacks, whatever you want to call them, hyperventilating, moaning, groaning over way less dire situations than Larry is standing. Obviously, this is a COVID thing. I get more scared than that kid when a normal person is 3 feet away from me at this point in my life. And here he is standing face to invisible face with the boogeyman, and he looks totally unbothered and not in a I'm too scared to function kind of way.
No.
He's just sort of...
He's not frozen in terror. He's just chilling.
Which is weird, and it's a good performance across the board outside of that, so he must have been directed to act that way. It's the only explanation I can arrive at, because he's...
Well, yeah, and this is not the trope where the kid who is being haunted by a monster or a ghost or whatever and is not scared of it when he or she should be.
Yeah, innocence of children again. It's also not the thing where, like, his autism prevents him from recognizing danger, because it doesn't. He figures out that Larry is no bueno way before anyone else does.
Every other Larry encounter, again, basically gives him panic attacks.
Right.
So this one is weird. This one is a weird outlier.
The whole scene, that whole scene is weird. A lot of the stuff that happens in that parking lot is just peculiar, beginning with that first newspaper scene. So, like, with the sticky hand or the newspaper, both of those undermine Larry's presence in kind of the same way. They pinpoint exactly where he is, like you're playing a goddamn video game and trying to figure out where the other guy on the map is. And it's just sort of... I mean, that stuff can be scary. I like all the stuff in the first two Alien movies where you're looking at, like, a little dot moving across, like, a Pac-Man maze, basically. Like, oh no, Dallas, it's getting closer, that kind of thing.
Right.
But that's always just non-specific enough to where there's still some ambiguity and some wiggle room and some uncertainty. Here, it's just too much information, and I would have been better, especially in that first encounter where the only thing that needs to happen is the dad needs to pick the tablet out of the box. We should have just had a flickering light in that scene, and then eagle-eyed viewers would have thought, oh no, Larry's nearby. But right. Nearby is all you know. And that could be 10 feet. That could be 100 yards. Who can say?
Yeah. Well, even if you want to do the newspaper thing, like, maybe you have one or two pieces of newspaper hit the Larry figure and then very quickly blow away.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like, okay, you have been given a split second notification as to where Larry is, but there's no guarantee that that's where he is 3 seconds afterwards. And so it accomplishes the same thing, but better. But this way, he literally gets hit by about a dozen pieces of paper.
Yes.
And they all get plastered against him. And yeah, he's just in the same place for like 30 seconds. It's like, okay, well, we know exactly where he is. Cool.
Generally, the more you see of Larry, the less intimidating he becomes, which is true of many horror movie monsters, to be fair. I already complained about his E.T. hands. He looked like he was after Reese's Pieces in that sponge scene that goes nowhere. There's a shot of him, again, back in the parking lot, when he's menacing the dad for the final time, leading up to the car chase. We see, I think it's through the phone. I'm pretty sure he's looking through the camera. We see him lumbering around outside the booth, and there's just a shot of like his knobby kind of spine jutting out over the top of the glass, and he just looks like a stillborn stegosaurus. He's just so fucking big. Obviously, you know, Slenderman dimensions are scary. I mean, that stuff has a kind of impact. I mean, I don't know if it's cultural or what to attribute it to, but it's just certain monster physiques just freak people out, you know, certain characteristics. But Larry he's like tall and gangly, but he's real thick in the middle. He's got like a barrel chest. There's like a weird combination of too thin and then too bulky, and it's weirdly distributed. And by the time you get a good look at him, I don't know, he just doesn't pass muster for me, at least.
Yeah, I think that's
I think he's weird looking enough that I liked him more than monsters that we've bagged on from like Polaroid or His House.
Right. Yeah, he's a cut above that, but you're right in that there is a little too much E.T. in him, particularly at certain points.
Well, yeah, and then when he's going to clasp hands with Oliver, it's like the poster art, practically. He doesn't extend the pointer finger, but other than that.
And weirdly enough, this movie was produced by Amblin Partners.
Really? So. I did not catch that.
Yeah.
Speaking of the handshake at the end, I have a few points of contention with that scene. So part of Oliver's whole deal is that he needs you to, not Oliver, part of Larry's whole deal is that he needs you to finish the book. And by God, he's going to hold your eyelids apart and Clockwork Orange subject you to it if needs be, which is what he proceeds to do when he hijacks the television. And the book gets, I think it divulges way more of Larry's lore, if you can call it that, than I think it really has to. It's all about how windows become doorways and Larry is lonely. And if he takes your hand, then he'll never let go. And there's a picture of him dragging you into his nether realm.
Yeah, I think actually the picture is him dragging like a figure that looks like Oliver.
Through a screen.
Through a screen. And then on the other end, Oliver looks like an Oliver-sized Larry.
Uh-huh. And, oh, and the longer Larry inhabits, Larry's time on our Earth is limited. And indeed, we see him flickering a little bit when he's menacing them in the bedroom. The mother and son are under the bed, and it's kind of a funny shot. His feet are planted on the ground. It's almost like he's sitting on the bed as you would after like a long work day, going like, like he's just taking a breather.
This fucking family running me ragged.
Swear to God. And this is shortly before the kid starts yelling, field, field, field. We see his ankle meat kind of become semi-transparent for a second. And it looks like maybe he's about to run out the clock.
But nothing really comes of it.
Well, no. And the mother knows because she was forced to read the whole book. So she knows the deal. They just have to outlast him. But instead, she takes this Faustian bargain where she thrusts her hand into his, knowing what she knows, you know, that she's going to be carried off into some void space between the dimensions. I don't know. It's just that doesn't sit right with me. I feel like if you're going to force the characters and therefore the viewer to read the whole book on like the fifth or sixth attempt. So there are some pages that we see in this movie like five or six times.
Yes.
If we're going to have story time that many times, I feel like they should be taking notes, the characters. They should do us the courtesy of, I don't know, retaining all of that information if it's going to be forced into our eyeballs.
Well, not to mention, there's the scene around two-thirds of the way through where mom and dad, like, piece together all of the details in the space of 30 seconds.
No time at all, yeah.
And then they don't seem to retain any of that. And it's weird, too.
Well, the takeaway there is we'll break this one tablet,
right,
and that'll be the end of it. Job well done.
I guess they just purge everything after they feel their mission has been accomplished.
Uh-huh.
Well, and the thing about it, too, is why is it set up that once you have read the book, you're already doomed if mom has to go volunteer her soul? Like, it seems as though, like, because Larry is holding his hand out to Oliver. Oliver and mom have both read the entire book at this point. Why does Larry not just take Oliver?
Right.
It seems like there's still an element of choice there, which kind of weakens the whole conceit of the film.
Yeah, it's like once you say Candyman five times in the mirror, your goose is cooked. Or it should be. I mean, that's like the folkloric. The story only has folkloric resonance if that's how it works. You know, you make the mistake and then you pay the price. If there's a lot of middle ground where you can still weasel out of it, then yeah, that does rob the monster of a lot of his gravitas.
Yeah, you don't say Candyman five times and then Candyman pokes his head out of the mirror and says, "May I?" You know,
like, don't mind if I do.
Can I?
Someone say my name five times.
Shall we? You know, like No.
You also never get any shots from Candyman's perspective on the other side of the mirror, just being a pervert, watching people brush their teeth.
Those were very silly.
it made Larry seem kind of pitiable in a way that I thought, I thought something was going to come of that, that it was going to be a fucking Sesame Street, there's a monster at the end of this book kind of situation, where they'd make it to the final page, and Larry actually was kind of toothless and pathetic. But no, after we see him drain the mom dry, the guy means business.
But he also apparently wants to protect Oliver.
Yeah, I didn't buy that at all.
That was... Why? Why was that the... Why?
The movie just has kind of delusions of grandeur in the lore department. I mean, she's really reading between the lines on that one. And then there's also a scene, just... It's the penultimate scene, I think. We didn't talk about it. Where... I keep wanting to call him Damien.
Byron.
Right. And then I almost just called him Brahms. Byron comes up to Oliver at school, and they have this losers club pact now where, you can come sit at our lunch table, but only if you do the secret handshake. It's only for kids who have seen Larry. We're going to make sure that none of us are ever lonely again, so he can't frighten us anymore. And it's just kind of sappy. I mean, they're elementary school kids. I can make my peace with that. But it hints at this, like, and we're going to come back in 27 years to make sure he's dead. It's like, no, where is this coming from? There's not going to be a Come Play Part 2 that's 2 hours and 45 minutes, I guarantee you. This movie kind of felt like it was 2 hours and 45 minutes at points.
You know, don't let me forget, that actually reminds me of an idea I got at the end of this movie that I thought was kind of interesting.
Okay.
But overall, this movie really just feels like it's trying to shoehorn in a few too many tropes at once.
Yeah.
Like you say, there's a lot of it there. It's doing the heroic parental sacrifice thing while also doing the monster was kind of a good guy all along. You can't do those at the same time.
No, a lot of these tropes do put the filmmaker at cross purposes, I think.
Yeah. It's trying to do a lot at the same time, and yeah, a lot of it does not work together. They can't coexist.
And it doesn't help when you've seen some of these tropes executed better any number of times. It's not just the storybook element, in this case, a digital storybook, that reminded me of The Babadook. I mean, Babadook is also about a mother with a special needs son, a misfit son of some kind. It's not autism, I don't think, in The Babadook, but the kid is troubled. And right. Is a handful. And there's a scene in The Babadook where she screams at him when he's in the backseat, why can't you just be normal? We get that exact beat in this movie.
Yeah.
I say this over and over again, which is a little bit ironic, but it's been there, done that.
Yeah, right.
And the kid being definitely certifiably autistic in this movie, there were times when I thought that it was better than average representation for that sort of thing. I mean, it is light years better than the cliches that you see in some movies of this ilk. You and I saw The Predator 2 years ago, I think, 2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
Where that kid is introduced as the kind of movie autistic child.
Autism is not a superpower.
Exactly. Yeah,
movie.
That's the trope. Yes, exactly. Where, like, he has a photographic memory and he's a chess virtuoso, and that belongs in the 90s. And in that way, it's a very Shane Black kind of touch.
Sure. That's true.
But where was I going with this? Okay, so the kid is more down to earth than that. But the movie gets into a little bit of trouble, I think, with its screed about how we're spending too much time on our screens and so on. The phone is his security blanket. I mean, it's a coping
mechanism. And also how
he
communicates.
And it's also how he talks. Right. And granted, I'm glad that speech therapy starts going better for him at the end, but
it's going to remain integral.
Yes.
We have every reason to believe. And yeah, okay, maybe he can spend less time watching reruns of SpongeBob. I grant you that. But still, screens are going to be important for this kid his whole life. Tone down the rhetoric a little bit. Anyway, circling back around to the thing I alluded to briefly, Guillermo del Toro co-wrote a series of books, and they were later adapted into a show on FX. It's The Strain. It's a vampire thing. It's kind of vampire as pathogen, but it's also sort of supernatural. But anyway, the thing about it is that when someone is infected with this, they're worms. They're like vampiric worms, basically.
The worm.
Are you the worm? You married to the worm? Yeah, no.
That sounds like a Pink Floyd lyric out of context.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Go watch Possessor. It's better than Come Play.
Yes, easily the case. But anyway, so when you get infected with the worms and you turn into a vampire creature, your bonds to your loved ones draw you back to them, and the worms use this as a tool to infect more people.
Uh-huh.
And it's the central character and his son. They lose the third member of their family, the wife, the mother, to this disease. And then she basically tracks them through this bond with her son. It's an omnipresent thing. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because I had this flash of basically a sequel to Come Play, where Gillian Jacobs' character, Mom, as sort of a pseudo Larry at this point, is drawn to her son, maybe in part believing in what's left of her mind that she's trying to help him and loves him and is trying to protect him, but is really trying to turn him into another one of them, or trying to kill him or whatever. That would be kind of interesting to watch.
Given the happy tears on everybody's face in that last scene, I don't think that's what was on the writer-director's mind, but I think you're onto something. It would have been... This movie already ends on such a downer, I would hate for it to be even more bleak, but that would leave the door open to, as you said, something a little bit more interesting than what we got. So I think it's fair to say I have mixed feelings about it. But that mostly comes down to... You haven't seen Pyewacket, have you?
No.
Pyewacket also ends on a huge bummer and is a kind of middling movie. And whenever I see like a very middle of the road movie that tries and more or less fails to end with an emotional wallop, it leaves a particular kind of bad taste in my mouth where it's like, this movie has kind of just made my day worse and not left me any better for it. You know, it hasn't like enriched my life and then like played games with my heart and then left me feeling like shitty, but also kind of elevated. It's just like, oh, that sucks.
It's just fucking depressing.
And that, yeah, and that's kind of when I saw the mom's face go like, that's sort of how Come Play left me feeling. So if you were going to double down on the sadness, that feeling might be even more compounded. But all of this would be solved if Come Play were just a better movie. So
true.
That's, you know.
Yeah. And again, like we said during the synopsis, that shot of Gillian Jacobs' face having the life drained out of it along with the sound effects does squick you out. It's spooky. Easily the spookiest image in the film.
Yeah, far and away. I have three, I think, parting shots. I will try to do them in ascending order of complexity, but none of them are all that complex. First, the movie is a little bit too hung up on would-be scary repetition. You know, take, 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 that kind of
thing.
Yeah,
that was just kind of silly.
Brahms, the little bully boy, Byron, at one point starts chanting after he's emerged from his catatonia. He starts chanting, Larry just wants a friend, Larry just wants a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps echoing over the next shot. It's just like, I can't be rid of it. It's right there in the title, Come Play With Us. That's scary. You know, little kids chanting things can be scary. But execution is always everything.
Yeah, it's not automatic.
No, it's in fact, I would say that the default is for it to be merely annoying. I mean, you have to...
Yeah, no, do it right or don't do it at all.
Right.
Is the takeaway.
And that's true of everything, but horror movie kids are so easy to get wrong. This movie is actually better than average in some respects when it comes to that. And I've pointed out some ways in which it's better than average, but it does also fall into a few regular traps. I probably made the field foreshadowing sound just glaringly obvious. It isn't, actually. I mean, I gave the game away, but it's executed rather neatly, I thought. I mean, you can imagine if the bullies had attacked him in a quarry and, like, thrown his phone into a little body of water or amongst some rocks, and then the next day in speech therapy, the therapist had been teaching him his cues. Can you say quarry? It would have been like, oh my God, here we go. But field is innocuous enough that it didn't occur to me until after he started going field, 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 more chanting. So I just want to make clear that it wasn't as bad as I made it out to be. do my due diligence there. Lastly, before we move on to our recommendations, I invoked the specter of the hash-slinging slasher episode, and it was on my mind throughout. Basically, from the first moment I saw SpongeBob, I flashed back to our Pet Sematary review, and I kept thinking every time a goddamn light bulb started flickering in this movie, or sputtered out, or exploded into sparks, I thought of that scene where Squidward is going through the checklist of things that portend the arrival of the hash-slinging slasher. And I looked up the list to be sure, as I haven't seen this episode in well over a decade. It's the lights will flicker, sure enough. The phone rings, and the walls will ooze green slime. Oh, wait, they always do that. That's the gag that has been stuck in my brain since I was a child. And I just kept thinking, you know, like, the fucking hash-slinging slasher has more tricks up his sleeve than poor old Larry. Larry can only make the lights flicker. He doesn't get past the first item on the hash-slinging slasher's to-do list. It's just, as soon as I arrived at that realization, I mean, the movie would not have scared me regardless, but after that it became chronically ridiculous every time. Every time the lights started flickering, I wanted the phone to ring. I wanted the walls to ooze green slime. And every time with the goddamn light bulb, it's way too much of the same. Larry needed to bone up on his poltergeisting 101. I know that he's a demon of electricity to a certain extent, but that already kind of doesn't move me. So for that reason, I'm not married to the idea that he can only affect sources of light and car alarms. It's not enough. It's just not enough for a feature-length movie, I don't think.
Yeah, and that's actually a good segue into our recommendations segment, because I wanted to open mine with sort of a commentary on something that befalls a lot of these horror movies. It's become, I say these horror movies like I'm referring to the whole genre, but that's not what I mean. In the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, it's become increasingly more and more common. And I don't know, maybe I'm just out of my depth and I don't realize that this used to happen frequently as well, but it seems especially prevalent in the last decade where a horror filmmaker, you know, a young filmmaker just kind of trying to get their start, makes a short. A horror short that makes a splash, racks up a bunch of views online, or wins awards at a variety of prestigious festivals, and that gets buzz going on them. And then, rather than just getting a springboard to, okay, I'm going to make an unrelated horror feature, they always get money to make a feature-length version of their short. And a lot of the time, these shorts are not ready for prime time when it comes to creating a feature-length version.
Well, the feature-length version just always feels like it's had all this extraneous material grafted on to a relatively simple concept, because that's how it happened.
Yeah, you know, this is true of Polaroid. This is true to a somewhat lesser extent for Lights Out, although that feature on the whole was okay. Still, short is definitely better.
Mama, also okay. Short was better.
Right.
We talked about that relatively recently. As you said, it's a bit of a pandemic.
That being said, I think I will, in this context, recommend Mama, because okay, I do like it better than Come Play.
It's got that mom-child thing going on, too, big time.
In a way that makes a lot more sense.
A thematic sense. I mean, thematic. It's thematically resonant in that movie. It's there in the title, obviously, but it's baked into the whole conceit in a way that it isn't here.
Yeah, and so it's Andy Muschietti, who, in case you're living under a rock, has proceeded to do It and It Chapter 2, which have grossed, in Matt's phrase, $1 billion at the box office.
Slightly less than a shit zillion, or slightly more. I'm not actually clear on how that shakes out.
Where a fuck billion falls on the fake number scale. But yeah, he made a like 3-minute, very tight, very lean horror short where basically these two little girls are fleeing from Mama. And at first we just think, oh, you know, their mother's very strict or something. It's like, no, this is not a human entity. It's spooky. I mean, there's nothing more to say about it. Just watch it. It's great. It's on YouTube. Easy to find.
Yeah, Guillermo del Toro was singing its praises from the rooftops, which is kind of how it entered a lot of people's.
This is how the director of It and It Chapter 2 became the director of It and It Chapter 2, mm-hmm. basically.
And Mama, like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, had a little bit of... If you asked like the average Joe on the street, there's a non-zero chance that they would think that Guillermo del Toro had directed those movies. I've sure. complained about this before. You know, God help you if you make a horror movie produced by Guillermo del Toro, because no one will know your name. Everyone will just take that producer credit and run with it.
Right. Well, I guess they just think that every movie is Poltergeist.
Right.
Anyhow, the feature-length version obviously has to be a little bit more complicated than that. Jessica Chastain has adopted her brother's two daughters. The brother is deceased, and they have been surviving for a great deal of time out in the wilderness, protected by this entity they call Mama. And basically, it's just kind of a spooky, Del Toro-esque, sort of uncanny creature.
Yeah, it looks like something you'd see in Crimson Peak, actually, which came out not long after, a year or two after, I want to say. So it's definitely in his wheelhouse. Mama, the entity, also slots nicely into that overzealous guardian angel framework that I was talking about.
But again, it makes more sense there.
Yeah.
And the resolution at the end of the movie, Mama, works way better than this one does because it's all organic. So I would recommend Mama. It's not a perfect movie by any means, but it does have a lot going for it. There's one sequence in particular with a camera flash that mm-hmm. is quite effective.
I thought about that once or twice with all the camera business in this movie. In Mama, it's flash photography, so you're illuminating the ghost, the spectral presence, for a fleeting instant, and then waiting to, like, manually... It's an old-timey camera, is what I'm trying to say. In fucking Come Play, it's just a night vision enabled Apple branded device where you can just kind of swing it around like a damn night vision camera and just see everything there is to see. There's not a lot of... The only suspense there is, are you going to be looking in the wrong place at the wrong time? But there aren't as many complications, if that makes sense.
Right. I'd also, this isn't a movie, but since I brought it up, I'd also like to recommend the book series and the TV series, The Strain, because they're cool. Books are better. They were actually written, at least in part, by Guillermo del Toro. The TV series, it's got a little bit more of a basic cable vibe to it, but it's still quality. It's just not, it's not like watching a TV season length series of del Toro films. It's not of that caliber. But nevertheless, it's a good time. I would recommend it. So, yeah. Over to you.
I wanted to launch into this whole back half of today's episode, and I decided against doing this because I'm a big fan of Dr. Sleep, and Haunting of Hill House has enough standout moments in it that I've kind of come around on Mike Flanagan. But my initial gut check watching Come Play was, this is a poor man's Mike Flanagan. Especially at the end. It goes, the phrase we sometimes use is Flanagan soft. It goes all Flanagan soft at the end in a big, yes. big way. And so I thought, I'm not going to say poor man's Mike Flanagan. I will say that it's a little worse than Mike Flanagan at his worst. This is like, Come Play as a poor man's Before I Wake. It's
there
a,
you go.
Larry is a poor man's Canker Man. it's just... And so I want to recommend a Mike Flanagan movie, but I don't know which one exactly. I've actually still never seen Oculus, so maybe I should take my own advice there.
Matt, I recommend that you watch Oculus.
Thank you, Jim.
I'll do a recommendation for you.
Outside of Dr. Sleep, I think Gerald's Game is his best work, but that's too far afield from the kind of Flanagan movie that this movie is aping.
Yes.
I guess I would say Ouija, Origin of Evil. If you haven't seen a Mike Flanagan movie and you don't know what
Flanagan soft is,
or what qualities Come Play lifted from his oeuvre, then Ouija, Origin of Evil will give you a few pointers. Ouija, Origin of Evil is actually a pretty decent example of the Pie Wacket syndrome, where it's like not quite good enough to be such a fucking bummer. Ouija, Origin of Evil is one of the few Flanagan movies that does end with a little bit of a gut punch that isn't resolved in a happy, sappy kind of way, if memory serves. I think his hands were tied because it is a prequel, and so it has to be the tragic backstory for a different, altogether shittier horror movie.
It leaps and bounds shittier.
So it has to end badly and sadly. I'm starting to sound like fucking Misunderstood Monsters over here. I will eat them on a train.
and badly and sadly, and Larry will eat you gladly.
So, Ouija Origin of Evil is fine. We've covered Dr. Sleep before, so I don't want to recommend that one. Just check out a Mike Flanagan joint, I guess.
Well, Absentia also kind of ends sadly and badly.
I don't know. Check out a Mike Flanagan movie. That's all I got for you this time. Check out Ouija Origin of Evil.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, on that note...
Or Oculus. I hear it's good.
It is good. I like Oculus. So, with that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap things up here. So, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Come Play Official Trailer HD in Theaters Halloween, uploaded by Focus Features. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, February 14th, and we'll be discussing the latest Benson and Moorhead film, Synchronic. See you then.